bit of an unusual sermon this morning in that it's on a portion of the text that tends to be glossed over. We're in John chapter 11, the story of the raising of Lazarus, but this sermon is on the last part of that story, which is the response of the religious authorities, verses 47 to 57. They convene an official meeting and reach an official decision. Verse 53, from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. We've known all along they didn't like him. Seen them spontaneously try to stone him to death twice, first in chapter 8, then again in chapter 10. In chapter 9, we learned they had made a decision that anyone who believed he was the Christ would be banished from the community. So in the flow of the story, this is no surprise. We've seen it coming all along. And I think that's why this portion is rarely dwelt on. Not that anybody's trying to hide anything. It's more like, why bother? Chief priests and the Pharisees, we know they're the bad guys, stock villains, cardboard cutouts. What's to learn? What we'll learn about by attending to this passage is evil. We'll learn about evil. Obviously not a pleasant subject, yet another reason it tends to get bypassed. But since it's a very real factor in the story of Jesus, and a very real factor in our lives, we'll spend some time on it. Consider what God may want to show us by observing it. Last week, I mentioned that something was missing from the story of the raising of Lazarus, that being the response of Mary, Martha, and everybody else to Lazarus coming forth zombie-like out of his tomb. Must have been quite a scene. But all we're told about is belief and unbelief. Picking it up at verse 44, and he who had died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, loose him and let him go. Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. The contrast in verses 45 and 46 between those who saw it and believed in Jesus and those who saw it and went away to tell the Pharisees about it is a contrast between belief and unbelief, but not in the way it might appear at first pass. It's not that those who went to the Pharisees didn't believe Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. They had seen it with their own eyes. They believed it. That's what they went to tell the Pharisees about. They believed it, but they did not believe in him. There's a reason it's challenging to learn about evil. It can be difficult to comprehend. Doing evil, being evil, involves choices and decisions. Yet human nature is such that we lie to ourselves about those choices and decisions, and with remarkable consistency end up doing evil in the guise of doing good. Jesus presented everyone who encountered him with a stark choice. In his own words, he who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters, Luke 11:23. There is no midpoint, no neutral ground, no compromise. You cannot serve two masters. It's either or. In more common biblical terms, light and darkness. There's a reason that's such a fundamental biblical image. Light and darkness do not mix. They are antithetical. The more there is of one, the less there is of the other. He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already because he has not believed in the name of God's only begotten Son. And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. John 3:18-20. There are only two options, two choices, two destinations. But choosing is a process. Here in John 11, in response to Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, the leaders make their choice. They seal their decision. But all along, John has been showing us the process. After his opening prologue, verses 1 through 18, the first thing he told us about was a delegation sent from the leaders to ask John the Baptist who he was. Chapter 1, verse 19. Now this is the testimony of John when the Jews sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, "Who are you?" Chapter 3, verse 1. There was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night. He's coming to Jesus, but it's on the down low. There's a controversy brewing. Jesus seems to be intentionally offensive, purposefully violating their Sabbath regulations. In chapter 6, his "Eat my flesh, drink my blood" sermon drove away many who had been following him. In chapter 7, at the Feast of Tabernacles, we read verse 12, there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. There is no mediating position. He is polarizing. The Pharisees and the chief priests sent the temple guard to arrest him, but they came back empty-handed. The leaders asked, verse 45, why have you not brought him? The guards replied, no man ever spoke like this man. The leaders retort, are you also deceived? Have any of us believed in him? In chapter 8, they try to trap him with a woman caught in adultery and then stone him to death for saying, before Abraham was, I am. In chapter 9, he heals a man born blind with the requisite Sabbath violation. And the Pharisees convene a tribunal, verse 16. Some of the Pharisees said, this man is not from God because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? And there was a division among them. It's becoming painfully clear to everyone there isn't going to be any meeting of the minds. They cannot fit the round peg of Jesus into the square hole of their expectations. In chapter 10, verse 20, many of them will say, he has a demon and is mad. Why listen to him? Others reply, these are not the words of one who has a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Same song, next verse, a little bit louder and a little bit worse. In chapter 11, in the little town of Bethany, just a couple of miles outside Jerusalem, Jesus very publicly and very dramatically raises the dead. Stood outside the tomb among the mourners and said, Lazarus, come forth. And he did. Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him, but some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did. That brings us to our text, which begins at verse 47. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, what shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and nation. And one of them, Caiaphas, being high priest that year, said to them, you know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people, and not that the whole nation should perish. Now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then, from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. Therefore, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples. And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple. What do you think? That he will not come to the feast? Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it that they might seize him. As we focus on evil, we'll see three things about it. First, it is intentional. Second, it is irrational. And third, it is servile. But before we do, I'm going to play a film clip, a relatively long one. It's over 8 minutes. It's from the 1977 television miniseries Jesus of Nazareth, which on balance tends to be my preferred movie version of the story. It was certainly made from the perspective of faith, but it takes some dramatic license, condenses, conflates, introduces a character here and there. The story is smoothed out in Hollywood fashion, not strictly accurate. Enough variation to put off some serious Bible believers. But though I'd certainly rank myself among the most serious of Bible believers, I still find it overall to be my favorite version. It's 6 hours long and well worth your time. Anyway, this is its presentation of the Sanhedrin meeting where the decision was made. And I'm showing it to you because I think it conveys the human dynamics in the process. It's not a documentary, it's a dramatic recreation. But it's important for us to sense the human dynamic, to be able to imagine real people, even ourselves, in the situation. Because we tend to relegate evil to monsters, drug lords, Hitler, Genghis Khan. The fact is, it's often done by ordinary people like you and me. With that said, here's a dramatic recreation of the meeting where the chief priests and the Pharisees decided to put Jesus to death.
And we did nothing.
No.
He then drove the merchants and the sellers of beasts for sacrifices from the courtyard of the temple, and we did not intervene.
How many times have we protested at the disgrace of money changers being allowed in the precincts of the temple?
But then we allowed him to preach in the holy temple itself. And at no time did he recognize your authority, Caiaphas. Nor made submission to the elders of Israel.
Denounce him in the name of the people of Israel.
I'm not sure that we have that right. Can we honestly say that we represent the true thoughts and aspirations of the people of Israel?
What do you say?
I've often wondered if, as elders, we're not too cut off from them and from their real problems. How can we guide them if we don't know what's in their hearts?
But without our guidance, they would be lost. The people. People will run after any new thing. That's why they've taken up with this man Jesus with his tricks and exaggerated promises.
I have seen him. I've heard him preach. His words reach into men's hearts, not like ours. It's not the old ritual, the old formulas, but a new vision which seems to answer all their hopes. A message of comfort, of goodness, of purity, of the virtues of humility.
We've heard it all before, from John the Baptist and hundreds of others.
And why not? That is the richness of our religion, that it's always being kept alive by new ideas.
Oh, that kind of thinking encourages false prophet.
What an incredible people we are. Thirsty for knowledge, but hypocrites afraid of change. We say that we want new ideas so our religion will speak to each generation. And yet, when a prophet appears, burning with faith and fiery revelations, we stifle him. Shall we go down to history as a people who destroys its prophets?
Oh, yes. No, no, please. No, brothers, please. Look, this is scarcely the time for philosophical discussions. There are more urgent problems to be considered.
He allows those who follow him to hail him as the Messiah.
He's a blasphemer!
He's an imposter!
With respect to those more learned than I, there is one possibility that it seems no one here is ready to consider.
What is it?
A possibility that Jesus of Nazareth may be, in fact, the Messiah awaited by our people.
A carpenter from Galilee.
This man has studied the prophecies, and carefully and subtly, he never misses a chance to identify himself with them.
Exactly.
I only know that, like our brother Joseph, I've heard him preach. I was moved, lifted out of myself, and seemed to see all things in a new and blinding light. I was aware of wonders, signs that God may be with him, and through him, with us.
Realize what you are saying, Master Nicodemus. Let him speak.
Listen to him. Let him speak. Don't shout him down.
The coming of the Messiah is the heart of our faith. Why should he not come now? Why do we dream our liberator will be revealed in glory, a new Solomon, new David? Is God not allowed to choose whom he wishes? Even the son of a poor carpenter from Nazareth? David began life as a shepherd. Who are we to decide the way in which God should choose to help his people? We? Grains of sand, chaff blown in the wind. May the Lord open our eyes to his wisdom.
Master Nicodemus, I have always respected you. How am I to understand your defense of this man, whose mission seems to be to divide our people? Even this noble assembly has been torn asunder by him. This Jesus of Nazareth must be an extraordinary man. But is there not one among you who understands the real significance of this matter? It is not the Galileans' words that are important, or the so-called miracles, even the fact that frenzied crowds hail him as the Messiah, it's not important. The central core of this case is that this man dares to proclaim, and I can hardly make myself say it, this man dares to proclaim himself the Son of God. Master Nicodemus, in your great faith and wisdom, and you, Joseph, most honest of men, can you tell us that in your heart of hearts, you believe he is the Son of God, that he is equal to God? If he is not the Son of God, then who is this Jesus of Nazareth? Is he a prophet? Only a false prophet can assume the powers of God and say to a persistent sinner, "You are forgiven." Only God can forgive sins. All through our history, false prophets have been the plague of Israel. This man, while claiming to uphold the law, perverts our most fundamental beliefs.
The Romans will not wait for us to find the answer. Our law says the prophet who claims to say
in the name of God, things which God has not commanded, that prophet must die. But if this man Jesus is a false prophet and a blasphemer, is it not better for one man to die than for a whole nation to perish?
However, under Roman occupation, Caiaphas, the people of Israel may put a goat to death, but not a man.
Thank you, Zero, for reminding us of our realities.
Then he must be charged and found guilty by the Romans.
A word about Caiaphas. He was not only high priest that year, which I take to be 32 AD, he was, Josephus tells us, high priest from the year 18 to the year 36. And as the one who determined to sacrifice Jesus, so also he was the one who made it happen. In the quote-unquote trial of Jesus at which he presided, the false witnesses were tripping all over each other, and Jesus wasn't saying anything. So Caiaphas stood up and said to Jesus, "I put you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus, speaking for the first time, replied, "It is as you said. Nevertheless, I say to you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven." Caiaphas then tore his robes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. What further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard his blasphemy. What do you think?" And they answered, "He is deserving of death." Caiaphas was the point man, the trigger man, high priest, official representative of the nation. He's the one who made it happen. In the fun facts to know and tell category about Caiaphas, and there aren't many, but the one I know is, we have his bones, literally. In November 1990, construction workers widening a road in Jerusalem inadvertently opened an ancient tomb containing 12 ossuaries. Ossuaries were the bone boxes where the Jews of that time did their final burial procedure. There's an especially ornate one which contains the bones of a man about 60 years old, inscribed with his name. Everything fits the New Testament time frame, and it was not a common name. It is widely, though not universally, accepted that they are, in fact, his bones. The ossuary is on display in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. Well, let's talk about evil. And the first thing I want to tell you is it's intentional. It's not an accident. It's not a mistake, not a misunderstanding. It's on purpose. The chief priests and Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do?" They had a situation on their hands. They hadn't asked for it. They didn't roll out of bed that morning and go, "I feel like being evil today." They were under pressure. Pressure brought by Jesus. As we mentioned earlier, it had become clear there wasn't going to be any compromise. Jesus was not interested in cutting a deal. It was going to be him or them. And the crowd, the people, was siding with him. In the leader's own words, "This man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him." Now, granted, that line on its own is like epically bad. You know, everyone believing in Jesus, horror of horrors. Everybody loving God, everybody loving their neighbor. We've got to stop this thing. That's what it sounds like to us. That's not what it meant to them. They, not unreasonably, saw themselves sitting on a powder keg. The groundswell of support for Jesus was bringing things hazardously near to a tipping point. They were on the verge of a rebellion against Rome. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. What they fear as the people flock to Jesus is a spontaneous uprising. Things just getting out of hand. It can just happen. And if it did, the Romans would come and they would put it down. Taking away their place, the city of Jerusalem, and in particular the temple, and their nation, the limited sovereignty they enjoyed as obedient subjects of Rome. You might remember back in chapter 6, feeding of the 5,000, it's verse 15, when Jesus perceived that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he departed to the mountain by himself alone. That's the crowd, that's the people, that's what they want to do, and that's what the chief priests and the Pharisees are afraid of. The problem is not that their fear is unreasonable, it's that, as Nicodemus put it in the clip we saw, there was one possibility they were not ready to consider. The possibility that Jesus was in fact the Messiah. And we broach here a subject of interesting but unbounded speculation, and that is, what if they hadn't rejected Jesus? What if they had accepted, received him as the Messiah? Well, I can tell you straight up, I do not know what would have happened. I am confident of two things. One, God would have worked that out somehow. I do not know how. But two, more importantly, they could have. Their rejection of him was their choice. And that's the practical point for us. Understanding the evil was on purpose. It's what they chose. It was their intention. They convened the meeting because Jesus raised somebody from the dead. They ask themselves, what shall we do? They conclude, kill Jesus. They were unwilling to imagine what believing in him might have brought about. They didn't want to go there. Had a clean, simple solution, happened to involve murdering him, but at least the math was real simple. It is better that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. You and I, looking at it from the outside in, going, truth, justice, what about Jesus' message, his miracles, his innocence? Those questions bring us to our second point. But before we get there, let's be sure we've acknowledged evil is intentional, because we do not like to acknowledge that in our culture. It offends a very basic assumption we have. And that is that humans are basically good. By definition, no sane person would choose evil. The very act of choosing evil demonstrates they're insane, mentally ill, unable to distinguish right from wrong. We think this way because we imagine humanity to be inherently good. Round and around that reasoning goes. That is how we look at it. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Jeremiah 17:9. That's how God looks at it. And he's the one who happened to be murdered because it was convenient. Evil is intentional. With that acknowledged, we can move on to the stunning fact that it is also irrational. And now we're really going down the rabbit hole. We're going to try to talk rationally about that which is irrational. We're going to reason about the unreasonable. And let me set the table this way. How did Satan tempt Eve? With the promise, you shall be like God. How'd that work out? Not so good. Satan's a liar. You want to make a note of that. What does God accomplish with the gift of his only begotten Son? Beloved, now we are children of God, and it has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. That's 1 John 3:2. We shall be like him is God's holy promise. Genesis 3:4, you will be like God is the devil's wretched lie. I hope that raises at least a little cognitive dissonance for you, because if it doesn't, you're not paying attention. Is it evil or good to desire to be like God? It depends. Depends on how you get there. You want to do it through submission to him or rebellion against him? Evil is irrational in that it defeats its own purpose. If you want to claim, fight, rebel your way to being like God, you will end up in hell. That is not a desirable outcome. Not what you were after. But if you believe in him and submit to him, if you do it his way, he will lift you up. You shall be like him, which is what you're after. But evil is crazy. It's self-destructive. Forget the morality of it. It's bad strategy. It doesn't work. In our text, the religious leaders decide to kill Jesus to protect their place and their nation. And I hope I've made it clear that was not an irrational fear. They weren't paranoid. There was a real danger of a revolt breaking out. And if that had happened, the Romans would have certainly showed up in force. So they decided to sacrifice Jesus to save the nation. It was expedient that one man should die for the people rather than that the whole nation should perish. You have to know a little bit about the Bible and a little bit about history to appreciate how epically wrong they were. In the triumphal entry, which occurs very shortly after this meeting we read of in John 11, Luke tells us, chapter 19, beginning at verse 41, as Jesus drew near, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, "If you had known, even you, especially in this, your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you, surround you and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation." The enemies Jesus is prophesying about are the very same Romans the religious leaders fear. The chief priests and Pharisees decided to kill Jesus because they thought it would protect the temple, the city, and the nation from the Romans. Jesus weeps as he approaches because he knows the Romans are going to besiege the city, destroy the temple, and scatter the nation because the chief priests and Pharisees did not receive him. It's like perfectly backwards, as wrong as it could possibly be. The exact opposite of what they're trying to accomplish. Evil is irrational. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't work. Still, there's a lot of it around. Which brings us to our third and final point, which is that evil is servile. That is to say, subservient. It is submitted to, comes under the good purposes of God. We've talked about their decision and their reasoning. Verse 50, it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish. That's what they thought. That's what they said. It is entirely true, but John calls our attention to a higher truth. Verse 51, now this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Caiaphas' words had a far deeper meaning than even he knew. And what's shown us here is the glorious sovereignty of God even over evil. Because this is the evilest thing ever. The torturous murder of the pure and innocent Lamb of God. Yet from this evilest of acts, the greatest grace and the highest glory will flow. The veil will be torn, the way of salvation will be provided, a fountain of blood will be opened that not only cleanses all who draw on it from evil, but will ultimately wash all evil away forever. As I know we're taking communion today, I can't think of a better place to stop. Amen.